Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review, stick it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to download and listen to. And it's been a while since the last episode. I guess I was reading this book and it took longer than I was expecting, and another book which I've finished reading which I've not got to review yet because Juliana's not finished it, and another book that I read for another podcast. You know, just all the different things come together and I've been busy at home catching up on podcasts. So this is finally I'm getting to this book after literally 1 month of reading it, and it did take me quite a long time to get through. At the start it took me a while to get through because I was just doing other stuff and wasn't really busy, but in the second half I must admit it took a long time to get through because I just wasn't enjoying it very much and it became a bit of a slog. The book that I'm talking about is Joan D. Vinge's The Snow Queen, first published, it says here on the Goodreads page, in 1980. And it says here, this reissue of a modern classic of science fiction, the Hugo and Locus Award-winning and Nebula-nominated Snow Queen, marks the first time the book has been reprinted in 15 years. So, well, I guess that must have been since... that version is from 2001. So, yeah, this book is pretty old. It's as old as I am, 37 years old, this book is. And, in and out of print for a while. The reason I'm reading it, though, is because I was looking back... Yeah, it's been 10 years now since I started the Science Fiction Book Review podcast, and I was looking back at, you know, some of the books that I read at the very start, and I remembered one of the books that I read, the last book that I read before starting the Science Fiction Book Review podcast, was Down Below Station. So that's one book that I've been reading recently, and then I looked at the first book I ever reviewed, and it's a book by Joan D. Vinge, and I was like, well, let's get to this book. The reason I'm reviewing this one directly after a book by Verna Vinge isn't because Joan D. Vinge and Verna Vinge have anything to do with each other, except, of course, they were married. It's not because I was like, oh, let's read another Vinge book after another Vinge book. It's just because, again, that little bit of nostalgia for early Science Fiction Book Review podcast, looking back at some authors that I did review early on and haven't reviewed for a long time or read for a long time. That's why I... That's why I continued on with Marooned in Real Time after the Peace War, which was one of my early highly rated books. And now, yeah, The Snow Queen. Let's get more Joan D. Vinge in my life. And this is one of those books, like Down Below Station, that was written in the late 1970s, early 1980s, which won the Hugo Award, but then kind of like drop out of the science fiction popular culture in a way that other books from back then didn't or don't. Maybe it's because they were written by women, like Down Below Station or Dream Snake by, I think, Vonda McIntyre, maybe? I can't remember her name exactly. But there's a few of these books which kind of just fall away from, sort of modern consideration of what these, the Hugo Award-winning books were in the 1970s and early 80s. Whereas, you know, all the books written by men are like, oh yes, of course, this is a classic, this is a classic, this is a classic. Maybe it's because it's written by women. Maybe not, I'm not sure. Anyway, so, I decided to give this book a go, and it was a month ago that I started it. And of course, it's called The Snow Queen. So you're thinking, I was thinking straight away, The Snow Queen, this is going to be a retelling of The Snow Queen. And it starts very, very similar. I remember listening to an LP, a record player. We had a record player when I was a kid, and one of the fairy tales, we had quite a few of these fairy tale LPs, sort of like, you know, telling the story as you go through with some sound effects and some music and some different characters doing it like that. Some different, different voices doing the different characters, is what I'm trying to say. And Kai and Gerda and the Snow Queen was one of those records that we have. So I couldn't remember the full story, but I was remembering, you know, oh yeah, it's Kai and Gerda, and Kai gets like a splinter in his eye or something like that, and then he turns bad and can only see the bad in people, and Gerda has to go and defeat the Snow Queen and get rid of the spell on him and defeat him and stuff like that. So that's what I was expecting overall. And that's kind of what you get here. You get Moon and Sparks, and they have a similar kind of story. They grew up together, they're cousins in this book, and you know, the love has to conquer all, and and get Sparks out from his spell that the Snow Queen has cast on him. Sure, that's all that. What I wasn't expecting is this book to be very, very much in the vein of Dune and a bit of Star Wars as well in there. But the setting of this is a planet which is, as I was going through, I was like, this is kind of just like Dune, except with a watery planet instead of a desert planet. And there's these ruling colonists from, you know, like a wider empire, which is keeping this planet, you know, under their rule and saying, oh, you can't have this technology, you can have that technology. So that's a, you know, very much, you know, like the water empire, but not a water empire of you know, water, but of technology, you know. So if you want to keep them down, just remove all technology from the planet and they'll be cast into sort of low colonial position. And there's like a spice, form of spice that extends life and makes people young and fit, and it's only available on this one planet, and this planet is called Arrakis. No, it's actually called Tiamat. And then it's harvested from, you know, this unique form of life which is only found on this one planet. And there's people who live on the North Pole, in a city at the North Pole, which is a spaceport, which is, you know, is full of off-world technology and trade, but they're kind of like a bit too close to the outsiders, and they're not really respected by the people who live across the rest of the planet. And the people who live across the rest of the planet are free and live low-tech lives and go around in a way which is, you know, difficult to understand for everybody else, but they've got, you know, they can control the means of transport going around the rest of the planet. And if you actually manage to get off the planet, you need a navigator to, you know, to be able to get across, in this case, these wormholes. But, you know, you need a navigator to get you between the different planets. And as I was reading these different things, I was like, oh, this is, again, it's not that it's sort of like similar to Dune in a way where you're just like, oh, I'm not enjoying this, it feels like a Dune ripoff. It's more like, oh, these are just, maybe they're just the tropes in the world after Dune. You know, I've read these things where people go, oh, well, Star Wars is exactly like Dune because it's a desert planet and it's this hero's journey and there's an emperor and they, you know, there's a duel with, you know, with these different kind of swords, and there's like the Bene Gesserit are a bit like Jedi, and then there's Jabba the Hutt, who is this worm creature emperor, and there's this, you know, this thing in the desert which swallows people and all these different things. And I was like, yeah, I get it, I understand that the science fiction in this time, influenced by Dune, there is a lot of that going on. However, in a lot of those other things where it's sort of like, it's just Dune, but it's just on an ice planet. You know, the story that can be told in those places, I think Dune with an ice planet is, I think it's the, is it called Nevinus or something by David Zindel? That's one of those things that always comes up with me and I'm like, oh, that's a good series. You know, it feels a bit like Dune, but it's like an ice planet instead of a desert planet. You know, that whole kind of like a world ecology with a, you know, with a planet which is kind of kept down by the colonialist powers, and they have to, you know, rise up and get their planet out from underneath the heel of the empire or the hegemony. However you pronounce that word, I can't say it. Every time I want to say it, I can't say it. So, what we have here is a world which feels, you know, a little bit too familiar, and a story that feels a little bit too familiar, crossed with a story which feels a little bit too familiar, because by design, this is kind of a science fiction fantasy retelling of the Snow Queen. And that's kind of, overall, doesn't make for a satisfying story. Now, again, it could be a satisfying story, but in this retelling, it just isn't. Because, you know, I've seen the Snow Queen retold before. You know, it's almost like the Disney Frozen thing as well. There's two sisters, and one turns bad, and, you know, and then they have to be turned from the dark side back to the light side by the love of the sister. And I'm like, all right, that's kind of what I'm expecting going in, but it didn't really come across very well. Partly because the main characters are just very flat and boring. And I think that comes from having to say, okay, we're going to do a fairy story. And what do fairy stories have? They have evil villains. They have young heroes and heroines, you know. And if someone turns bad and love has to get them back again, you know, there has to be this, you know, continuous love story all the way through. And someone's like, oh no, I just love him so much. I've got to go and, you know, I've got to turn him back from the dark side. And he's going to come back again. And, you know, even though he's done all these horrible things, I'm gonna bring them back from the dark. Of course, this was written in 1980, so of course this can't be influenced too much by all of the Star Wars thing. And actually, I was looking at some quick reviews just to get the spellings of the names of people, a lot of other people are like, hey, this is like Dune plus Star Wars plus the Snow Queen, like the, you know, the Anderson original there, and I'm like, yeah, it really is very much that, and there wasn't enough to go with it. Jay reviewed it 4 stars and stuff like that, is there's this part where he says, Jay? She? He? Maybe? Can't see. So this climax in the middle part of the story, the hero finally meets up with the primary protagonist. They go head-to-head in a duel on a narrow bridge over a vast abyss. Midway through, our hero learns a stunning piece of news regarding a parental figure and is then tempted to join the villain in an evil scheme to rule the galaxy. And you know, when you're actually reading this in the book, you're like, yeah, sure, this was written at the same time as Star Wars, maybe slightly before, maybe slightly afterwards. I'm not quite sure how the timeline works out of when it was written and when the movies were released and all that kind of stuff, but it feels very much like, as Jay says here, like just 3 years after Lucas made Joseph Campbell a household name, this book was written, and you're like, yeah, there really is this kind of thing where you go, oh, okay, and like in Dune, there's going to be a duel at this point in the book, and he's going to use his technology from here, and this person's going to use his, you know, knowledge of this other, you know, more more primitive way of fighting in this case, and that's going to be the thing that's going to get him in with the leaders, and it's going to move the story forward at that part of the thing. Anyway, like I say, all the influences and all the references and how it doesn't feel fresh to read this anymore, all of that aside, like I say, the characters are just too flat. You've got Moon Dawn Treader, which is the main character, and her cousin, Sparks Dawn Treader, so it's Moon and Sparks, and Moon is just mooning over Sparks, and Sparks is just this like, oh, I'm gonna be a good guy, oh no, but I have to turn bad, and him turning bad didn't really feel convincing, but in the fairy story he turns bad because, like, there's something stuck in his eye, this shard of something stuck, I can't remember exactly what it is, but something's stuck in his eye and that makes him bad. But in this book they're like, oh well, he has to turn bad, so then, like, from chapter to chapter he suddenly, like, skip forward 5 years and now he's a bad guy and he's doing evil stuff and he's manipulating people and he's killing things and he's going out and clubbing seals to death. And I'm like, a little bit on the nose to just go out and kill these these semi-intelligent sea lions as a signifier of, you know, evilness. And of course that happens in other books as well, to bring it back to Dune. You're like, you get, oh, the Harkonnens, you know, they bite the faces of these things and kill these people and have sex with these boys or rape these people over here. And, you know, that's all these signifiers of being evil, but it's not suddenly like, oh, and now they've just turned evil. Like, there's a little bit more depth to people going on. And then you got the Snow Queen herself, which her name is Arianrhod, and she's just boring because she's just sort of like, I like the idea that you can have like a complex character, and like, oh, doing bad things for good reasons or doing good things for bad reasons. But as we were going through this book, I was just like, okay, so she wants to, like, just kill half of everyone for, and then I was like, why did she want to, like, what's she gonna, she wants to just kill lots of people, but then I can't really remember what's going on there, you know, I can't, like, why is she doing this thing again? But, like, of course she's gonna kill lots of people and she doesn't mind because she's evil or she's meant to be the bad, you know, the antagonist here, like, I get that, but I couldn't remember what the logic of the situation was to make these some people bad and some people good. It's sort of like, oh well, the story requires this person to be bad, and I was like, yeah, but, like, I understand why she's doing it, but suddenly, like, is the only way to do this thing just to kill half of the people on the whole planet? Didn't really feel quite correct there. And I was kind of weirded out at the start by these are cousins and they're fucking each other, and I'm like, this is a bit, like, it feels a bit icky, and then I'm like, okay, so it's not technically incest, but then books where, you know, you have people fucking each other, but it's not technically incest, it's sort of like, oh yeah, they're not biologically related, but it feels still a bit weird. And if that's the main romance, or that's the main driving force all the way through the book, I was like, shouldn't you be, like, not fucking your sister anymore? I mean, of course, they're not sisters, they're, like, you know, non-biologically related cousins and stuff like that, but when you're brought up together and you're like, it just feels a little bit weird. And then later on he's like fucking someone else, and I'm like, but isn't it a bit weird that you're fucking a clone of your cousin now? And I'm like, oh, that's a bit weird too. And then Moon, who must be like 19 years old at this time of the book, she starts fucking someone who's like this, you know, ex-police chief. So I'm like, well, if you're the head of the police on the planet, it means you must be sort of at least past middle age by now, and you've not been a police chief for a while. But then I was thinking, actually, you know what? This is not, even though he's probably more than twice her age, and it is a bit icky, it's a bit weird, at least it's like an adult consensual relationship, unlike a lot of the other relationships in this book. So you've got this you've got this like these three main characters. All of them are a bit flat, a bit boring, and because these main characters are the ones who are so closely drawn to, or so closely parallel to, the main characters in a fairy tale, they are all the flattest characters, because in the end what they have to do isn't dictated by what they think or what they feel or what they like would do illogically. Their actions are dictated by what happens in a fairy story that this is a retelling of. So in the end, I never believed anything that they ever did. I never believed their motivations. It always felt like they were just playing out the characters in a previous story, and then it's sort of like, here we're on a planet with two suns, but it's not two suns like Star Wars. No, really, there's two suns here that's different because there's a black hole and stuff like that. So it's not like Star Wars that there's two suns, but really it isn't anything like that. So it's one of those things, really strange. However, a lot of the rest of the characters I really enjoyed. There's this police inspector, Jerusha, and then these are these other characters like Tor and Pollux, who are these, you know, underworld, you know, bad people, and Fate Ravenglass, who makes the masks and things, and then Gennet, and there's this alien called Silky, who, like, disappears halfway through the book, and I kind of almost forgot him by the end of it. But when I was, you know, again, I tried finding the names of these characters so I could share them here, because when I'm reading, when I'm listening to audiobooks, I don't always make a note of that, so I want to get the character names correctly. And I was like, oh yeah, Silky, the alien as well, one of my favourite characters, up until he disappears halfway through the book and then he's just never mentioned again. I was like, oh yeah, there are actually lots of interesting characters doing interesting things, and they're interesting characters doing interesting things because their storylines aren't dictated by a slavish fixation on a Joseph Campbell hero's journey mixed with Dune, mixed with the Snow Queen and things like that. So there are actually a lot of interesting characters doing interesting stuff. However, all the time we spend like a chapter with them and I'm like, hey, I'm getting into this person's story. Give me more Tor and Pollux, give me more of Jerusha, give me more of Gandolini and all these other characters, and the aliens and these squad of smugglers and stuff. I'm like, yeah, let's have a whole novel with these guys over here. And then we're like, no, let's go back to Arianrod, let's go back to Moon Dawn Treader, let's go back to Sparks and their tedious journeys of double-crossing each other and trying to outwit each other and stuff. And it's all politics, but it's boring politics, it's not the good stuff as well. So yeah, there is good in this book in terms of characters, but it's not in the main three characters, in this main love triangle at the centre of the book. Then we have a big problem with the pacing of the book. This is a long book. Let me quickly go across to Goodreads again. 448 pages paperback. It's about 20 hours of audiobook, and there is about 8 hours of story in this audiobook. It is long. And at the start, I was like, oh, maybe it's just slow-paced. But there's a big difference between something being slow-paced and spending time to concentrate on characters and spending time to concentrate on world-building and spending time to concentrate, you know, on the good language and descriptions and all that kind of stuff. I don't mind a slow-paced book. However, the story has to be there. And it took me a while to understand why I was always, like, not so interested in what was happening. It's because all the way through the book, there is only, at any one point, one thing that you, as the reader, don't understand or don't know yet, or hasn't been revealed yet. But there are lots and lots of things which characters don't know yet, but you do know. So, like, there's one character who knows something, and then we have to spend, like, a full chapter of, like, this other character finding out that thing. And it might not happen that chapter, it might happen four chapters later. And then another character can discover the same thing. So there's this whole thing of, like, there's this character called Starbuck, and one of the characters is like, well, who is Starbuck, you know? Is Starbuck this character or this character? Or who is this character and why does nobody know? And it's sort of like, we all know who Starbuck is right away, but it feels like a massive section in the middle of the book is just different characters coming to the realization, who is Starbuck? Or who is this other character? Or are they Starbuck? And it's like, yes, I already know this. And it's sort of like this long thing, sort of like, oh, so wait, you're telling me that this character is actually Starbuck? And I'm like, yes, it is. And everyone's like, oh, right, that explains so much. I'm like, yes, I already know all of this. And time again, I know something as the reader, another character knows something, but we've just got to spend ages of these other characters discovering this. Or like, I have a plan. I was like, great, you have a plan. And then they follow out the plan, or the plan works out. And then like, I have to spend another three chapters of everybody else in the book coming up to speed of what's happening. It's like, say, oh, you mean you're the Snow Queen? Oh, you mean this is going to happen? Oh, you mean, oh, wow, that's going to happen like that? And I'm like, yes, I read that four chapters ago. And now you're just telling me other characters discover what's going on. And this happens time and time again. And it's not just about like one thing happens, then the other characters catch up with it. But at any moment, there just isn't enough going on. There's only ever one thing that I don't know. And then that gets resolved, but you have to go around every person, every other person that you go through. So then Erenrod gets a chapter, and Sparks gets a chapter, and Moon gets a chapter, and Jerusha gets a chapter, and Pollux and Tor and Pollux get a chapter, and then another person gets a chapter, and then you get back round to the first one. It's like, I didn't need all of those people to have a chapter just to fill in what's happened so far, and then the next thing starts happening. So it's just too long. And it felt at the end like 7 hours from the end of the audiobook, and I was like, well, we've discovered everything, we know what's going to happen now, we're through to the end, they've said what the plan is, we don't know, nothing else needs to be revealed, that's it, so what are we doing now? And it felt like the last 7 hours of this audiobook were this book being wrapped up, like, okay, what's going to happen with this person? Well, I guess they've got to have a scene with this thing, and then this person's going to become the queen, and then this person's going to not become the queen, this person's going to stay here, and this person's going to leave, and this person's going to fall in love with that person's going to get a love interest to resolve over there, and this person's here, and it just carries on. And then 3 hours from the end, I was like, surely this must be the end, and this last 3 hours of this audiobook were the most tedious 3 hours, because, again, everything had been revealed, everything was set up, and it was just playing out what had been set up through the end of it. There was kind of one final reveal in the last 4 hours of the audiobook, where, you know, the whole question of what is the Sybil network and what is that for? And that's kind of like a mystical thing that some people have, like the gene to be able to, you know, communicate with the world's core or something like that. It's leftover technology from a previous galactic empire, whatever, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, great, okay. So that's been revealed, but it doesn't do anything in this story. It reveals slightly what something has happened or why this one person has this one power. But it doesn't actually make doesn't make me think, oh, now that's been revealed, the rest of this story is going to go in a crazy new direction that I don't know. It's like, no, it's just going to play out. We're going to defeat the bad guy. We're going to become a ruler. We're going to do this kind of stuff. This person's going to pay off. This love story is going to pay off over here. And it just goes, oh, it's just so not great. It's just so long. And normally when a book is long or slow, maybe it's just the story isn't interesting, but it's so interesting in this case to be able to put my finger so perfectly on why it felt like it was dragging. It was because at every moment there was only one thing left for me to discover, and I wasn't really interested in that, but all of the other characters had to be brought up to speed all the time at everything that had just passed in the last three chapters. It felt for every chapter that any story moved forward, there was four chapters of just bringing everyone else up to speed and making sure all the other characters knew what was going on. So, not good pacing. What else do I have here? I put this theme. One thing that I did notice here was probably for the time, this was quite groundbreaking in that most of the characters, or most of the important characters, are women, are female. There's, you know, there's the Queen, there's Moon, who is like the main protagonist, the police chief is a woman, there's all these other characters who are very important to the plot who are all women. And in and of itself, for a book in 1980, sounds pretty good. No problems with that at all. However, and I don't want to put a however on a positive feminism note, it did feel very much of its time in that there's this police chief called Jerusha, and she is a woman, and the main thing that she has to work against is the fact that she is a woman. And it feels almost comical these days to be reading science fiction where the main thing that you have to come up, like someone has to work against, is being female. And of course, that is a big issue. And even today, that's a huge issue. But it feels almost comical. I was watching Wonder Woman, and Wonder Woman is set in, like, in the First World War, and she, like, a woman enters into a room of all men, and they're like, how dare you bring a woman into the room? And it's sort of like, oh, you his secretary. Yes, I'm his secretary, because that's the only job that a woman can do. And it feels so crazy to me now, in 2018, looking back on this book from 1980, the year that I was born, and it's still being the same thing, that this, that Wonder Woman is taking the piss out of being, like, how unadvanced feminism was and how downtrodden women were in literally, you know, 1916 or 18 or whatever this this book, and in the same as 1980, where literally the whole thing was like, well, you can't be the police chief because you're a woman. And it's like, oh, that's it, all the time. But it didn't feel like the whole rest of the world was, like, you know, it didn't feel to me obvious that women couldn't be in charge in all of these other places. Like, there's a queen, and this person who is important is a woman, and this person who's important is a woman, and this person who is important is a woman, and this person's got an important job, and she's a woman too. And, yeah, so it was this weird thing that the person was constantly fighting against the fact that she was a woman, and of course she wouldn't succeed because she was a woman. But it felt so, I don't know, it felt so basic of a premise that now Wonder Woman is like, that's like a source of comedy or a source of levity, that it's so on its face absurd that a woman can't do a job because she's a woman, or someone can't have a job because they are a woman. Feels so, like, so basic. I don't know. I don't know how to say it, really, but it just felt so, like, dated and twee. And this is from 1980. Again, it's 37 years ago. And I'm glad science fiction has moved on, and I'm glad the world has moved on, that it's not just self-evident that somebody can't have a job because they're a woman. But, of course, that is still a big issue, and you know, as we see it in, you know, even presidential elections and things like that, sexism obviously had a massive part to play in that. There's just no way it didn't have a big part to play in that. So in some ways, I'm kind of, like, astounded at the, like, almost the naivety of the framing of the feminist issue at the centre of one of these character stories in this book, and yet at the same time thinking, oh yeah, maybe it is still the same even now. And there's a reason why that resonates in the movie Wonder Woman, and there's a reason why it does resonate. So I'm like, oh yeah, I've got to keep checking, you know, checking the privilege, but I have to keep, like, checking in on this issue in my mind and saying, oh yeah, just because, you know, all recent novels, like, I'm bored of reading male authors, and all the recent novels that have been winning Hugo Awards and all this kind of stuff are based around, you know, female authors or trans authors or the all these different issues, and it's very socially progressive now. And if you were just sort of like to write a book which was just sort of like, oh, and this person can't do anything because they're a woman, it'd be like, meh, that's a little bit, that's for science fiction these days, that's not really sophisticated enough for the science fiction world, unlike in 1980 with this book winning the Hugo Award. It just feels so dated. However, the rest of the world really needs to catch up with a lot of where science fiction is at the moment, where it's so inclusive and so interesting to read all these different points of view that, yeah, sometimes you've got to be reminded that in the modern world, yeah, you can't have that job because you're a woman, is still a very, very, very real situation for many, many people, for, you know, 51% of the population. So, yeah, it was an interesting for my first reaction to be like, eh, well, this is a bit pathetic, but then also me going, eh, actually, still a good point here as well. What else do I have to say about this book? What's my last note? Oh, yeah, the narrator, let me just quickly look on my phone who the narrator is, Ellen Archer, mostly an okay job until anybody starts talking, because I'm not sure why, the producer let her get away with this, the producer of the audiobook get away with this, but she decided to do different British accents for all of the different characters from Tiamat. Tiamat? The planet that this book is set on. So there's a variety of English accents, a lot of Scottish accents, because all of the people from the summer part of the world, which is like the equatorial part of the world, all speak in Scottish accents, and all the people from the north speak in English accents, which really, really, like, again, as someone from the UK, it's sort of like, well, that's a bit of a weird choice, because the actual Scottish people are from the north, which is a little bit more wintry than the south of England, but okay, so that's an interesting different flip there. Maybe it's sort of like, oh, you know, because the south is a bit more, you know, colonial backwards or something, so they're Scottish and a bit more primitive. Is that racist? I'm not sure. And then they're like slightly more technologically advanced people, but they're not the colonialists, so maybe the people from off-world speak in a, you know, in English accent. Anyway, and then there's some Irish accents in there as well. Anyway, this, while the choices of which accents go to where is a bit for me like, no, that's a weird choice. I wouldn't have minded it if she could do some like really good accents, but literally every second sentence by all of these characters, I was like, that is just not a good Scottish accent. It's close to a good Scottish accent. It's not like a comedy bad Scottish accent, which I kind of would have preferred, because I realised there's this uncanny valley of bad accents. You can either be like, and you can do a Scottish accent so badly that you just go, okay, well, that's just a bad comedy Scottish accent, and sure, like, you know, some Mike Myers kind of Shrek kind of thing. You're like, okay, that's fine, but it's not a real Scottish accent, it's a comedy Scottish accent. Great, no problem. Or you can do a perfect Scottish accent, and that's also fine too, no problem. But when you do uncanny valley accents, uncanny valley British accents, you're just like, no, you're just getting these three vowel sounds slightly wrong. Every time you say the word no, it isn't a Scottish no, it's kind of partly a Scottish no, but then it ends up not quite Scottish at all by the end of it. Again, my accents are not good. All of my accents fall into the uncanny valley of not good enough to be convincing, but also not bad enough or not comic enough or not broad enough to be a parody accent and stuff like that. So that was my main note of this. An uncanny valley of accents, which always made me feel a little bit on edge and a little bit like, oh, it's not quite right. Every time you're talking, all I can think about is the accent. I'm really struggling to concentrate on what the character is saying, because I'm always thinking, nah, you're not quite getting the vowel sounds at the end of this word right every single time you say it. Anyway, otherwise, okay, I guess, okay narration, but it really came down to apart from the spotty accents, it just came down to this book is too long, and it would just send me to sleep, and I think that's why this book took me a month to get through. So from starting it to the end, it doesn't matter, it's a 20-hour audiobook, and I've been listening to other things and other audiobooks and listening to podcasts as well. It shouldn't take me that long to get through, and I'm not going to blame the audiobook narrator for that, but it's not really a good audio. It's not, this book just isn't suitable for audio, I don't think. Also, fairy stories aren't 20 hours long. If you're going to tell it, like, sure, if you're going to do a retelling of the Odyssey and you want to make it epic, sure, big books, big chunky books, go for it. But fairy stories, this very easy, if this had been a 7-hour audiobook or an 8-hour audiobook, this would definitely have been amazing, because I wouldn't have been worrying too much about it. I wouldn't have had chapters and chapters of being caught up with different things, like, oh, this thing's happening over here, and now let's catch up with these people over here. If it was like an 8-hour audiobook, you wouldn't have the luxury to spend so much time with all of these characters, and the minor characters would have had more time to flourish if you just kind of like sideline the main characters a bit. I'm not really sure. But yeah, this is one of those books that I understand why it wasn't reprinted for 15 years. Again, maybe because it's a woman author, and a lot of these women authors who were winning Hugo Awards back in the 1970s and 80s, their books have kind of dropped out. But some of them, I think, are still very relevant and very good. This one, though, again, it won the Hugo Award. It's probably a book of its time. It's, again, it's a very Dune-like Star Wars-y book, but with women at the centre of it, and that's a great thing. But it doesn't really hold up much beyond that, which is a real pity, because at the start of this book, I was actually quite interested in it. And about halfway through, I was like, yeah, I'm really interested, but the last half of this book really let it down. So I'm going to give this book 2 stars for being a good attempt at something that kept my interest for a while, but then just really flagged. It's just way too long, way too baggy, and baggy in a way which isn't just sort of like, oh, too many descriptions, because I don't mind that. It's like not enough to keep my interest plot-wise or story-wise or mystery-wise or character-wise, and that's really difficult to overcome. Again, when I went 7 hours away from the end of the book, I'm thinking, are we just wrapping it up now? And it takes 7 hours to wrap up the end of a book. 7 hours to wrap up a 20-hour book in total. It's just not balanced enough. So that's it for me. Oh, yeah, normally I go over to Goodreads. What you should do is become my friend on Goodreads so I can see what you think of this book. This has got a 3.96 average rating on Goodreads and among friends of mine, which is pretty much SFBRP listeners at this point, 47 reviews at 3.43 average. So I'm coming in way under average, but a few people do seem to agree with me. Paul rated it 2 stars. Star Wars meets Dune meets something really boring. I mean, I think there is a bit more to it than Star Wars meets Dune. It's Star Wars meets Dune meets meets Hans Christian Andersen's The Snow Queen. And I think there's just a few too many layers of stuff that I've already read and already know this the stories for. Alex Hamill rated it 4 stars. It's good to see what other people, how other people rated it. Lots of these ratings are actually to read, so people haven't read it yet. But a lot of people think they're going to get to it in the future. That's it. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Luke Burridge on there. Become my friend on Goodreads and then sign up for the SFBRP listener group on Goodreads. And that's the best way to get me to read a book. If you say, Luke, read this book, and other people come into that same thread of books I would like to see reviewed and say, yes, I also want Luke to read this, the chances are very high that I'll get to it pretty soon and start reading it. So the next review that I do will either be, well, it won't be Down Below Station because Juliana still hasn't finished that and I'm not home for another week and a half. So what else is on my reading list here? Oh, I've got what's there in my Kindle app? In my Kindle app, I have, I think, a book by Pattern Recognition by William Gibson. I will get to that at some point. Over on Audible, I have a Praedar Moon, which is another book by Neil Asher. I read one of his series, and I'll get to that too. I got Red Mars as well, because again, another Hugo-winning book. I think it's actually not the first one won the Hugo Award, but another Hugo. I thought I'd just tick off some of these 70s, 80s Hugo Award-winning books that I've not reviewed yet as well. What else is it? The Patricia A. McKillip, I don't remember. Oh, the second Riddle Master book. I'll get to that soon as well. So those books coming up in future episodes. That's it from me. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.